All right, everyone, good morning, and welcome to the November 27, 2012 Peer Insight. The topic for today's discussion is optimizing infrastructure for analytics-driven real-time decision-making. Just a couple of reminders before we get started. If you're not speaking, please mute your line. You can press star 6 to mute, and then if you have a question, you can press star 6 to unmute. This call is being recorded. For those of you who are tweeting, please use the hashtag Wikibon, W-I-K-I-B-O-N. Also, we are streaming live on siliconangle.tv, SiliconAngle TV. And I think that's it for the intros. First of all, I want to thank Doug Leoden, who is co-founder and CTO of Tapid, who is joining us. If you are watching live on SiliconAngle TV, you will see him live streaming. He's Skyping in from New York today. Is that right, Doug? Welcome.
That's correct. Thank you.
Great. Thanks for being with us. Dialing in from the airport is Jeff Kelly. He'll be on mute except when he's asking questions or providing insight, so we won't get too much background. But Jeff, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And here in the studio with me is Dave Vellante, who's a co-founder and one percenter here at Wikibon.
Hi, John. Hi, everybody.
And David Floyer's on, as well as Bert Lattimore and the Wikibon community. So Doug, again, thanks for joining us today. We are going to talk about analytics real-time decision-making. And you've got an interesting environment there. For those people who aren't familiar with Tapid, could you just give a brief background on what Tapid does, and then we'll get into the discussion on the infrastructure that you use?
Sure. Thank you. So from a very, very high level, Tapid is an advertising technology company. What we do is that we give advertisers the ability to look at individual consumers as they move across multiple devices. So we're able to do what we call personalized advertising for users or consumers based on the behavior that we observe on multiple devices. So a typical consumer these days is using multiple devices to access internet services. So they might have a tablet and a phone and a laptop and or maybe a set-top box, a gaming console, or a TV. And for most ad tech companies, those devices will be presenting a very fragmented view of the user, whereas we try to give a more holistic perspective on how a single user is accessing services across the different devices. And we work with publishers and advertisers, so we enable publishers to sell, for instance, audience information if they have specific behavior associated with users that are visiting their laptop or regular web environments, and we might be able to help them leverage that data and sell it on other devices later.
So. We talk about real-time decision-making. How real-time is real-time? How long do you have to make a decision?
So most ad tech decision-making these days are based on real-time-based bidding, which basically means that as the ad impression is being served, that's the only time and place you know exactly which user you're looking at. And you have to make a decision on which ad and which campaign you want to show to the specific user as the page is rendering, basically. So the time frame from page load until the ad has to be shown to the user is typically somewhere below 100 milliseconds. Otherwise, the user will perceive that as lag. So from the time that the page load begins until the whole chain of decision-making has been made and the ad is being actually served, you have about 100 milliseconds.
And in the ad tech world, I mean, the ad that you serve up is dependent upon the user device. It's dependent upon what you know about the user.
Yeah, exactly. So it's all about the information that we have about the device or the user. And those can be simple things such as what kind of site are they on, what's their geographic location, and such things. But it's also, in these days, more about data that we know based on previous behavior. So let's say that we have seen a device associated with this device that has visited a site about cars, and we have an auto vendor that is running a campaign with us, then we might take a look at the device, see, okay, this device has actually visited a site about cars, and that makes the expectation of the value of this particular ad impression higher for this auto advertiser. So it's about taking a look at all the data that we have available about the specific device and also the devices associated with that device. And all this is, of course, something that needs to be stored for retrieval very, very quickly. And just in terms of volumes, ad tech, we have a lot of ad units and ad views flowing through the system at all times. And they're all very small requests, but they're data-driven, and they're in the range of, well, I know there are companies that are even bigger than, or much bigger than us as well, but we're looking at about 150,000 ad units per second at peak time. So, and all of these decisions are actually data-driven. So it's an interesting scaling challenge.
So you've got information, you're making 150,000 decisions a second, right?
We're actually making way more than that, because each individual advertiser campaign that is running in our system will need to make their own decision about the specific ad impression that's coming in. So there is an increase there in terms of 1,000. So we're talking about millions and millions of decisions, but the decisions are made based on the same data. So for each request that we see, we will typically make approximately 2 lookups in our data stores to see, to find all the information we have about that individual device.
Okay, so you've already sort of profiled the individuals. This is a person that might be interested in this kind of thing, and when they come online, then or when they make a request, then you pop up.
Yeah, I would be cautious to use the word profiled, but if we have seen the device interacting with sites that have signals that statistically indicate that the user will be more propensive to buy a product, then we'll make a decision.
Okay.
So I'm going to have to close the door here in just a second.
Well edited.
No, but it's to us, it's very important to debunk some of the privacy myths also regarding the ad space. And we try to use less inflammatory words as just one part of it. But it's definitely not user profiling. It's all about statistics.
Right. Okay. So let's spend a little bit of time talking about the infrastructure, because when you were building, making the decisions regarding infrastructure for Tapit, you must have looked at a variety of sort of back-end databases that you might deploy for your infrastructure. What did you look at, and what did you rule out right away?
Yeah, tell us about the tech behind all this magic.
Yeah. Well, it's long, big topic. But when you're looking at the kinds of data sizes, the amount of data we need to store, the latency and throughput required from a storage solution like this, and also the access pattern of a data storage solution. That's what you kind of need to take into account when you start looking at the data storage solutions. And I am not part of that camp that now will apply these new NoSQL solutions to any problem that I see. But to us, it became pretty quickly apparent that like regular solutions would probably not cut it. And I guess we could have made traditional relational databases work somehow, but they have a lot of features that we don't need. So the access pattern for our system is very straightforward. We have an identifier associated with each device that we see, and we need to to read a little binary blob, which contains the information we have about the device. We need to reread that on every single request. And then whenever we see something or we serve an ad or something like that, we need to update it. So it's a very, very straightforward put and get access pattern. So this lends itself very nicely to a key value store. So in NoSQL, there are a lot of different types of data stores these days, and they range from column-oriented stores to document stores, and then you have, there are many kinds, but the most simplistic ones are just the pure key-value stores that just basically support querying and updating single IDs. We looked at a variety of solutions for that. We looked at a variety of deployment solutions for that, so in terms of infrastructure. I don't know how much detail we should go into right now, but basically with key-value stores, scaling them typically requires a lot of RAM. So storing values in RAM is pretty straightforward. It's very, very high performance, and it's generally very fast. The problem is that in our case, we're storing in excess of a billion devices, and we have quite a bit of information about each of them, so maybe a kilobyte or so of data. So we very quickly, and if we include the keys, we very quickly end up in the terabyte range. And a terabyte of RAM is still something that is very expensive.
What's a terabyte of RAM cost?
That's a good question. I would have to Google that and check the prices for that right now. But if you're looking at server class hardware with a terabyte, that's going to put you down several tens of thousands. Of course, one server wouldn't be enough anyway. So you would need to look at multiple servers. And there's another problem with the RAM, and it's not just about cost, but it's also about the time it takes to bootstrap something. So if you need to boot a new server, put it into the cluster, and a restore will require you to read a terabyte of data from rotational drives into RAM, and that's going to take you a lot of time. Of course, if you have your servers, your storage partitioned maybe over 6 or 10 servers or so, the amount of data that needs to be read is way less, but it's still going to take a lot of time. And in either case, storage, such as in our case, we ended up using SSDs, SSDs are expensive, but they're way less expensive than RAM. And you can easily put half a terabyte or a terabyte of SSD storage in a server without breaking the bank completely.
What SSD storage are you using?
So we're using I'm actually not sure about the make that we ended up on. I think we're running IBM SSD drives. The difference between, there are two different, very different classes of SSD storage. You have the consumer grade and you have the enterprise grade, and there is still significant difference between these two types of drives, and it's about the fact that SSDs actually have read-write fatigue, or I don't know what the technical expression for it is, but it actually wears out. So as you use your SSDs, the flash RAM will actually decay and become less useful and lower performance. So you have to get the more expensive kind, but it's still, compared to RAM, it's way, way cheaper.
So, Dag, this is Dave Vellante. So it sounds like you're using the flash as an extension of main memory to give you a persistent layer. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yes, that's correct. So we're using our key-value store software is called Aerospike, and what they do with this key-value store is that they store the actual indices, so the indices of the keys, they store those in RAM, and then they store all the data on SSDs. So this means that the indices are, of course, a couple of orders of magnitude smaller than the actual data. So it requires less RAM, and it's faster to start up. But then the data is actually always stored on the SSDs and will never be cached in RAM. And this turns out to be very, very predictable in terms of performance. So every single read that we do that is not, or any read that we do for a key that actually exists, will always hit the SSD And as you know, the access time of SSDs are really, really good, so as in very, very small. So this, the combination of using RAM for indices and SSDs for the actual storage turns out to be a very, very performant solution.
Great, okay. And so you're saying that the Aerospike database is exploiting that architecture in a particular way that makes it, consistent performance, and judging on your earlier statements from the cost of RAM, much more cost-effective, presumably.
Yeah, it's more cost-effective and it's easier to scale in terms of hardware. So if you want to provision your service with 64 gigs of RAM, which is a fairly sizable RAM amount, but if you need 2 terabytes of storage, that's going to run you a lot of servers right there. And the problem with RAM-based solutions and in combination with the access patterns that we are seeing is that we don't really have any inherent caching heuristic that we can apply. All the 1.5 billion devices that we see, they can occur at any time. Of course, there are some heuristics such as if you have a page that's loaded and it has 5 ads on it, then it's likely we'll see 5 requests and we will access the same device 5 times. But other than that, we're seeing reads across our entire key space at all times. So a caching solution is not really that effective. What will happen is that your cache will be very quickly saturated, and then you'll start hitting your storage. And if your storage is not as fast as your, on a rotational drive, you can get access times now down to maybe 3-4 milliseconds or so. But you're still limited by that, which means that even if you have multiple heads in your drives and so on, you still have a very, very hard physical limit on how many reads you can do. So the problem with these RAM plus rotational drive solutions is typically that once you start getting a lot of cache misses, your performance is just going to drop completely off a cliff. And the only way to kind of work or resolve that is by adding more servers with more RAM. But again, 64 gigabytes is not a lot of storage, so adding a new server for every 64, of course, very inefficient. You can add then more and more RAM, but that will require you to get more and more expensive hardware to go with the RAM sticks. So it's cost-wise, way more cost-efficient to use SSDs. And again, compared to the predictability of knowing that every value that is being fetched will always have the worst case performance characteristic, which is hitting the persistent drive, is very, very convenient, especially when you have these very, very hard SLAs that we do. We have to respond within a certain amount of time, otherwise we're going to cause trouble for the website that is running the ads.
So the performance criterion is predictability and consistent performance, not necessarily the top-end performance, is that right?
Yeah, so that's right. If you have a pure RAM-based solution, then you will definitely have the potential to have lower average, maybe even, it depends on the access patterns, but you can have lower response times. But using the RAM and SSD solution will give you a very, very predictable response time.
Okay, and you mentioned before the wear issue of flash. Can you talk about that a little bit more? Is that a major concern of yours? How are you dealing with that? Are you just kind of, is the business case such that you can just burn through the stuff and keep replacing it because your clients, or you're able to monetize the data? Can you just
a little bit? So I'm not an expert on the SSD or SSD wear, but I know that there are certain access patterns. So basically, if you have a very hot spot on your storage, let's say an index file in a traditional database, you have a certain area of the drive that is consistently being read and written to, then you're going to have more wear on that specific area. And then there are certain softwares that techniques that can be applied that will more evenly spread the wear out across the SSD. So Aerospike has this built in. It actually uses the SSD drives as block devices. It doesn't care. It doesn't have a file system on them. It does everything like on the device raw, and that includes wear and tear protection. I know that I think I saw that actually Twitter had a patch to MySQL that did something similar for their own fork of MySQL. But there are some well-known techniques to avoid that kind of tear on the drives. And we use the Aerospike solution for this. We haven't had any issues yet. We've been running with the same SSDs now for a year and a half, so we're expecting some to fail soon. But if you can do a year and a half on each drive, then you can probably do more than that. But for us, we could easily replace all of them now and still have great value out of this. This is at the very core of our system. So for us to replace a couple of SSDs every year, that's not a big deal. And SSDs are dropping dramatically in price.
Going back to the RAM question just for a second, there are servers that can take you up to, I think, 512 gigabytes these days of RAM.
Maybe a terabyte, yeah.
A terabyte, yes. Why isn't that a solution with fewer servers?
So that would probably it is a solution, but again the price, I mean you have to look at I can't really quote any prices, but the price for a terabyte first the server class hardware that can accept the terabyte is pretty expensive, and getting the chips or the sticks of RAM that will give you up to a terabyte, it's going to be a very, very expensive solution. It's the traditional scale-up kind of situation. The problem is still the one I mentioned about getting this data into RAM is still going to be a problem. So if you have a single server, let's say you do two then for fault tolerance, let's say you could fit your data in a terabyte of RAM. If you bring a server online and it has a terabyte of rotational disks backing this, you're still going to have to read a terabyte of data into RAM before the entire data set is hot, so to say. And as I mentioned earlier, to us, we don't have any heuristics that will say this section of the data set will be less frequently accessed, so you start loading this other data set. If we did caching and loading into RAM only on demand, that would mean that we would have abysmal performance for the first, I don't know how quickly we can go through, but it would have a significant startup time. But there is certainly, the performance would probably have been, at least the latency per request would be lower in RAM. Until you start hitting the limits of the network adapter and so on, which you very quickly do when you have these kinds of volumes.
I was also wondering whether, when you got to very large RAM, you mentioned that there's very little locality of reference within your key pairs. So would that also mean that the larger the RAM, the less, the more the L1 and L2 caches would get overwhelmed, and then the performance starts to drop that way?
Definitely. If you compare, So that's at some point your RAM bus will probably become a bottleneck as well. If you're on one huge machine, then possibly depending on the access patterns and depending on the architecture of the server and so on, this is kind of this is not something you can be very black and white about, but definitely the caching part of the use of the CPU caches and so on can become an issue. The reason why we chatted about this earlier was because there was a blog post made by one of the Aerospike engineers about how you can set up a single machine to do a million requests per second. And part of the tuning there was actually pinning individual Ethernet ports to individual dies on the individual cores on the actual physical CPU dies to make sure that the caches were used in the most efficient manner and so on. But this is beyond what we're doing. But it's definitely an interesting topic, specifically now that we're in a period of time where the multi-core CPU revolution has just barely started, but in just a couple of weeks ago now, Intel finally announced their Knights Corner coprocessor series, which is basically a 50-core processor. And you really want to leverage the CPU caches on these kinds of server hardwares going forward. For us, for our key value stores, this has not been something that we've been looking into tuning, but I'm sure this is going to be an interesting area of research going forward.
I was wondering if we could turn for a moment to the actual use case a little bit more and maybe dig into some of the details of the actual process. Maybe you could walk us through a little bit more detail. What actually happens when the user logs on via a certain device? What exactly occurs in terms of the back end, in terms of communicating with the advertisers who are bidding? What's that kind of system look like? And maybe for those people who are not that familiar with ad tech, what does the kind of architecture look like in terms of how you connect with the actual advertisers? And maybe digging also to the analytic piece, the types of analytics you're running on the data.
Yeah. So the request chain of an ad being served, it typically starts in the user's browser by the fact that the publisher has a script include or an iframe on their page that loads the URL that points at some sort of advertising technology company. For us specifically, this can either be something that we're serving directly off of our servers, or in many cases it can be something that is served through what we call an ad exchange. And I guess I can spend a little bit of time looking at that model first, because the ad exchange model is something that has become more and more prevalent in the ad tech industry over the last few years. So basically, the browser requests an ad unit from an ad exchange back to the server. And this ad exchange doesn't necessarily or usually doesn't have any direct advertiser relationships on its own. But what it does, it actually broadcasts the information about the device cookie ID typically that they're seeing. They might have the IP address. They might have an ID for the site. They might have some keywords about on the page that is currently loading and so on. And they pass all that information back to multiple parties that are willing to potentially buy this single ad impression. And this is what we call a one-off auction. So basically, every potential buyer, then looks through its campaigns that it has running and the other data complementing the data that was passed through from the ad exchange and makes a decision for how much they're willing to pay for this specific ad unit. So in our case, for what we call, if we look at a performance-based advertising campaign, so by performance-based, I mean a campaign that has a certain end goal that we want to achieve for the advertiser. And that can be signing up for some sort of online service, making a purchase, or visiting a site, or whatever. The goal can be pretty much anything. And they associate a target value to that. So let's say we're driving, if you go back to the auto industry example, then the goal might be to get the user to that auto company's online car configurator or submit for a test drive, for instance. So we have a monetary value on each of those actions. And what our system then does is it takes all the attributes or features, as we call them, from the ad unit itself. So what site is it on, what size is it, what time is it, what geography is this user in, and so on. And then it complements this with attributes that we load from our data store, which might be what other sites have we seen this user on, have they visited the advertiser site before, what other types of devices do they have, have they had any other behavior on a device associated with it, and so on. And then we have machine learning algorithms that are used for predicting the probability that this specific ad unit will result at some point in that user doing what we want it to. So, and then the bid that is placed is actually based on the probability. So we have a target goal value, and we have what the machine learning models, the probabilistic models, are expecting the probability of the event happening, and they basically make a bid back to the ad exchange based on that. And then the ad exchange will review all the bids that it got in from the different potential buyers, and the winner is the one that places the ad. So that's one kind of full request cycle. So, yeah.
100 seconds or less, is that right?
That whole Sorry, what?
That whole chain is 100 milliseconds or less?
Yes, so that's typically 100 milliseconds, and that includes all the hops. So if we're running this through an ad exchange, it means that we will have somewhere between 50 to 80 milliseconds maybe.
So you mentioned, for instance, that the advertiser often will have they'll be running a program, and they'll have certain targets in mind. And you'll run your algorithm to help them determine the odds that the person will reach one of those targets. So you do that for each potential advertiser, which is a customized type of analytics against all this data for each advertiser each time there's a request. Did I understand that right?
And not only for every single advertiser, but also for an advertiser might have multiple campaigns running in the system, and the campaign might have multiple targeting strategies associated with it. So these might have different targeting constraints, but they also might have different goals depending on how the campaign is set up. So basically, every single targeting line in the system makes a decision about how much they're willing to pay for this individual ad request. So if it's outside of the targeting, the answer is very simply no, they're not going to pay anything. If it's a machine learning backed model and the targeting matches, then the model will be applied to the features that we have gotten from, so combine the stuff that is sent from the ad exchange or from the browser, is complemented with the features that we have in our data stores, and that is applied to make a prediction and then a bid value. But every single applicable buying strategy in the system will place a bid this is how our system is built. And there's nothing predefined about it. There's not no static predefined values here. It's all done in real time dynamically.
Well, that's impressive. I wonder, maybe could you put it in perspective a little bit? I mean, what did this sector of this market look like even, just 3, 4, or 5 years ago? How has this kind of evolved from the way advertising was done kind of at the dawn of the web through the early 2000s until now? It sounds like it must have been quite a revolution to reach the point we're at now with the type of use cases and applications you're talking about.
Yeah. First of all, I mean, Tapad is now 2 years old, approximately, and we've been fortunate that we weren't the first company to try to do this. So technologies such as SSDs and software such as Aerospike was available to us. We didn't have to build this from scratch and try to figure it out ourselves. So we're very fortunate. But yes, definitely, the ad tech space has evolved significantly over the last 5, 6 years. So if you go 5, 6 years back, then from the advertiser perspective, it was mostly non-data-driven, or well, it's not correct to say data-driven and not data-driven, but you will be able to set up targeting tactics or constraints targeting a certain type of browser in a certain state, for instance, based on the IP lookup. You could say something about, I want to target sites which have these kinds of keywords, and so on and so forth. But pretty predefined, statically, predefined things. Now, with the advent of what we call audience buying and retargeting and behavioral based targeting, it changes the picture quite a bit. There's a wide range of, I guess, sophistication and the amount of dynamicism that is that is available in these real-time buying systems. But for us, as I said, everything we do is based on the decisions rules that are being applied onto the data as we see the bid request or as we see the ad request coming in. The only reason why we're able to do this is, it's due to these storage solutions that allows us to retrieve information at the scale and at the latencies that we require. But it's also about modern CPU architectures and having very high-speed multi-core server hardware that allows us to do these kind of things. If we just started a couple of years before, then the hardware costs involved with building out a solution like this would have been a lot more expensive. And this even supersedes, I would think, actually Moore's law here, because just the access to affordable gigabit Ethernet and 10 gigabit routing equipment and so on is just something that has become so much, much cheaper over the last 2 years.
Outside of the ad tech industry, where do you see technology like RSpec being applied? What kind of applications make sense for a NoSQL approach?
The basic idea of a key value store, it's a very simple abstraction, and therefore it can be applied in many areas. I would not ditch the traditional data stores. I mean, we're running MySQL servers as well because they're really good at many things. So I wouldn't try to replace anything that would fit in a relational database with any kind of NoSQL solution. That's for us, for one. But this specifically, key value stores such as Aerospike, they lend themselves very well to data sets where you are looking at specific IDs. So you don't have to query. You don't need secondary indices. I know Aerospike is actually working on that, but that's not currently in there. But you want to have something like a memcache. I guess that's a memcache is almost equivalent to what you can do with Aerospike, except that an Aerospike is persistent. It supports transactions, and it's more fault tolerant and redundant. So I don't know. The use cases, there are many, many use cases, and there are also things you can build on top of key value stores. So you can build other types of analytics engine based on a very, very solid storage engine, which basically is what Aerospike is right now. I know, again, they are working on some other more advanced analytics features on top of that, based on a system called AlchemyDB. I'm not very familiar with that, but that will definitely broaden the range of applicable use cases for the system. But anywhere where you're using Memcached and you would like to have the data persisted, I would say that Aerospike is a good fit.
I want to make sure that we have time for we've got quite a few people online here with us. Make sure people have a chance to ask any questions.
Should let people know, too, you can tweet us. I'm at Steve Vellante, at Wikibon. We'll get your tweets online, your questions there.
Before we take some questions, Mr. Jeff, just wanted to jump in. I mean, some use cases that come to mind are really any data-driven real-time bidding process. So that could be applicable to the utilities industry, certainly to the financial services industry. Just two use cases off the top of my head that I can see where this type of technology would be certainly very useful, where you don't have the it's not just the scale, but really the performance and the time given to make a decision is sub-second. There's certainly beyond ad tech, there's definitely some possibilities I could pursue.
This is David Fly. I'd like to ask who your competitors are and what do you need to do to be competitive with them? Obviously, Google comes to mind.
So who Tapad's competitors are?
Yes.
Well, that's a very open-ended question. We work with publishers and we work with advertisers. And currently, the offering that we are providing is unique in the market space. So we're not competing head-to-head right now with someone offering the exact same product as we are. But there are definitely players, as you mentioned. I mean, anyone that has a lot of cross-platform audience information, you have Google, as you mentioned, you have Facebook, who we do work with. I don't think I'm going to call out specific companies, no. But in general, anyone that tries to maximize value for advertisers, we're competing with them. We have an offering that we feel very strongly about will increase the value to advertisers, and that we also feel very strongly about this holistic approach to looking at users as they're moving across multiple devices and providing analytics on how, let's say, ad impressions on a mobile device may affect users signing up for servers on their tablet at a later point that day, for instance. Those kinds of analytics are, we feel very strong that that is the right way to go about advertising in the coming decade.
You've mentioned cost, you've mentioned ease of scaling. What are the biggest drivers, and you've mentioned performance. What are the biggest drivers for your decision, and how fast are you having to scale?
So the decision was made about a year and a half ago now. We had been running a couple of other key value stores, one based on the JVM, based on the Java virtual machine, and one based on the Erlang ecosystem. And they both had pretty good performance characteristics, but had, well, when I say good, they're fast, but Aerospike is actually still like several times faster. But the main difference was actually how we were able to do a failover efficiently and adding nodes to the cluster without having any problems with rebalancing the cluster. That was the problem we were seeing with the other solution that we were running, is that when we were testing things, adding a node or having a node fail and then adding a new one and having them rebalance, repartition the data, it worked fine when we were testing it, but then when we actually had to do it in real life production, we had issues with it. We took a little gamble. We trusted that Aerospike would help us if we ran into any issues like that. We haven't had any issues with rebalancing at all. We have actually had several servers fail at the same time, not due to hardware error, but due to human error, as in unplugging the wrong equipment. And we have also increased the capacity of our server or cluster a couple of times over the last year and a half, and it has been working really well. I think one of the architectural smart decisions that were made is that the client is actually not a very thin client. It is aware of all the nodes in the cluster, and it will be aware of the latency that is associated with each node in the cluster, and it can use that for routing traffic. But it's not a pure client-based routing. It also has, so during a rebalancing, so when your data is moving or partitions are moving between the nodes in the server and in the cluster, the nodes themselves will actually also reroute traffic so they can function as proxies. So you kind of have fault tolerance both in the client driver and also in the servers themselves. So it is a very, very stable client-to-server system, and we had very, very few issues with it.
Can you give us some sense of the size of the infrastructure there? How many terabytes of data you're dealing with?
Sure. So we're currently running five of these CitrusLeaf nodes, and each server has we have six 120 gigabyte drives. So a total size of 3.6 terabyte of data. Now that is replicated with a fault or k factor 1, which basically means that we can afford to lose one node without losing any data. It's 2. We can lose 2 nodes. So it means that so we have a certain redundancy of the data, which means that we're not storing a full our data set. If we extracted it, wouldn't be a full 3.6 terabyte. And of course, we're also over provisioned in terms of storage. But I would say that the total data set is maybe somewhere in the a terabyte and a half area or something like that.
So it's not huge. all the maybe in the world of databases.
Now,
just a reminder to those who are, I'll try figuring out, just got the piano going in the background.
Yeah, that's fine.
If you could mute your line, if you're not speaking, that'd be great. Let's go.
It was nice.
Yeah.
Thank you. Well,
now, if you compare this data set to what the kind of data sizes that you're looking for, looking at, if you're looking at more tabular data sets that are used for like analytics processing in, you know, like a Hadoop cluster or something, that 1 terabyte is not enough, it's not a lot. But if you're looking at a data store that actually enables you to access this 1. Whatever I said, well, this more than 1 terabyte of data in less than a millisecond, including the network drift time around it, then that's something very different. And this is not,
right.
I mean, this system, this key value store is not a analytics database. I mean, it's not, you can compare this to something like an Atiza or a Vertica or a Hadoop file store, right, or HDFS. It's not like that at all. This is about having this data accessible in a very, very low latency, high throughput way. So it's you will need, and we use big data analytics solutions as well as like for doing database analytics, and that's not what we use Aerospike for. That being said, we are now able to do a lot of the processing and algorithms that we run. We can do them as we are processing a request instead of having to pre-compute them using an Hadoop cluster, because we have access to this data and all of it in a very, very low latency fashion.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point to make, that this is, you know, this, we're talking about a big time, real time transactional application versus some of the type of end user analytics that are often thought of when we think of big data analytics. Mm-hmm. You know, kind of returning to that question, the RAM versus flash question, you laid out very eloquently why this the approach that Aerospike takes is appropriate for this kind of workload. What is your take on for more analytic type workloads? Does that paradigm apply, or do RAM focused databases that don't employ flash are those appropriate for those types of use cases? What's your take on that?
So you're asking specifically about more traditional analytics, so counting,
right, so
and aggregating things, right?
Right. So we're seeing things, like SAP HANA, for instance, which is, also SAP can support transactional applications, but we're seeing a lot of more kind of end-user analytics on that. Is that something you think that's a viable solution for that more end-user analytics, or does the flash equation still come into play?
Sorry, can you repeat the first part of the question?
Well, just curious, the architecture you laid out and the way Aerospike uses SSDs in conjunction with RAM versus just RAM only, whereas we're seeing some in-memory databases on the more end-user analytics side that don't employ flash or SSDs. So just wondering, is that a reasonable approach in your opinion, or does flash also have a role to play in more of those end-user type analytics use cases?
So, if you're looking at a more traditional RDMS type of application or database, so let's say MySQL or a Postgres or a Microsoft SQL Server and Oracle, then I think that SSDs probably, they will increase the performance of your applications in many, many cases. When you're talking about more the big data solutions, so either a proprietary solution such as Vertica or Netezza, well, Netezza is actually out of question because they have their own hardware, but any of the big analytics engines and or like Hadoop and MapReduce built on top of Hadoop on HDFS, then usually your applications will actually be CPU-bound more than they will be I/O-bound. Actually, usually is wrong, but in many cases they might be. So a rotational drive, for instance, can have very, very high bandwidth when it comes to reading data sequentially. SSDs are actually not that great at having, well, they're fast, but compared if you do the cost per megabytes read off of disk per second in a linear fashion, then you might get a long way by using rotational drives. And for a lot of these, for a lot of the big data queries, the analytics queries that are being run, like you want to count the number of unique users that have visited your site, or you want to sum up the number of page views or whatever, those kinds of analytics, then you typically you're sifting through a linear data set and you're doing groupings and so on the fly as you're going through a data set. And I think that rotational drives with high capacity and traditional RAID setups will actually, I think they will live on for a while longer before they get completely overtaken by SSDs, just because they actually lend themselves very well to that. For smaller data sets where you want more random access, then SSDs are definitely a good thing.
Doug, we've got a question from Brian, came in through Twitter. He asked, could the matching optimizations and multi-platform identification be applied to massive social gaming?
Massive social gaming? I'm sure gaming or anything that is high volume will have a lot of the similar things. So, I mean, it all depends on what kind of data you need to have in order to make decisions. I mean, if you're updating user inventory somehow, or I mean,
weapons and stuff like that.
Yeah. It's a tough question, but anything that that needs access, random access to a lot of data and very quickly will probably be at least applicable for this. Yeah, definitely.
We've had some folks on in the past who are in that space, and I know they analyze a lot of the kills and stuff like that. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to go back, if I may, to you, what you were mentioning before, that you were doing some analytics in real time. Could you describe that a little bit more? Because this is, as from what I understand, a little bit more than just a transactional system. You're doing real-time analytics to decide things. Could you talk a little bit more about what those analytics are and the limitations of them and things you might want to do in the future to expand that?
So not just analytics, but in terms of the logic that we can apply. So typically, if you wanted to, in a more traditional, old school way, I'm saying that, old school, if you wanted let's say, implement a frequency cap, which is what we call, we use this for when you don't want to show the ad too many times to a single user, for instance. And typically, if you don't have access to a solution like this, then you could use the cookie store of the device to say, okay, I've shown you n number of ads, now we're going to stop that. But that kind of bloats the cookie store of the device a lot, and in many cases, you won't have the access to that. But instead, you would have to just store the ad impression log, and then you would have to go back on an hourly basis or something and run a batch offline job, counting how many users have been exposed to this ad and how many are above this threshold, and then put that in somewhere and make that actable in the next decision. Whereas when we have access to the real-time data store, we can actually just when we see an impression coming in, we can store that on that device immediately. And when we see another ad request coming in from that device in the same millisecond, even we will already be aware immediately that this device has now capped out. So that's just the kind of logic that I was mentioning when I said there are things we can do in real time. When it comes to analytics, we are not actually using the Aerospike platform as much for analytics as we might have been able to. So,
What I meant was additional analytics of the type you just mentioned, expanding, bringing forward into this platform, things you might do into this platform is what I meant, pure analytics.
So we have a lot of these kinds of situations. For instance, we're working with a lot of other ad networks, and what we do is we call multi or cross-device attribution reporting, which basically means that if we are working with a mobile ad network that is showing ads through this mobile app, for instance, and then they are tracking the impressions of those ads through our system, so we're storing in this impression history, and then at some later point in time, we see that user on a different device, but that is associated with this device that the other ad network showed an ad to, and we will see that user actually sign up for a service. then as that request comes into us, the notification that the user signed up for a service, then we will immediately have access to all the ad impressions that led up to that, what we call conversion, so the user actually doing something. And we will be able to pull out the impression history, figure out exactly which partners we worked with that were actually were participating in building up to this event happening, and we will call them out immediately. So we don't have to go back again. The alternative approach to this would be to have a like a nightly batch job that went through all the conversion events and try to line them up with the impression history and then calling them out. But we can do all these things in real time because we have the read and the write access to this data continuously, which makes some things much simpler, it's a big gain. But in terms of analytics, there are some interesting cases. We're using Redis for a lot of our real-time analytics because it supports it has these primitives for counters and bit operations and so on. The problem with Redis is that it's purely RAM-based. Aerospike has, in the last few months, actually gained support for things like atomic counters and so on, which makes it more interesting, you know, for using for more pure analytics. So, I mean, there's a lot of interest these days in stream processing and doing real-time analytics based on stream processing. And to do stream processing efficiently, you need to store the results of those streams or the results of those analytics. And putting that into a real-time type database or data store, I don't like the word database here, but a data store such as Aerospike or Redis or some other key value-based store that supports atomic operations like increments or even bit operations. That's something that will be very, very valuable going forward, I think.
So, and if I understand it correctly, the real value of this is that you can change the weightings and change the bid algorithms, the results of the bid algorithms in real time as things are developing. Is that?
Yeah. Both the bidding algorithms themselves, they will because they're looking at the data in real time. Looking at the data that is there exactly at that point in time, they will immediately. For a single device, the second that device has been tagged or added some sort of attribute to it that will be relevant for the decision making, next second that data will be part of the decision making. So,
okay.
Well, it's John MacArthur. I want to thank you for joining us today. It's very interesting. What I'm hearing a little bit is a proliferation of databases, not a consolidation around any single database. And,
yeah.
And really optimized for specific use cases. Is that a fair summary?
Yes, I think that's a very, very important thing to realize is that there is no, the reason for the growth of the NoSQL solutions is because there are certain use cases and usage patterns where specific types of architectures lend themselves very well. And if you want to cope with the scale and the growth that you have with a lot of the modern services that are provided to users now, you have to not just use a single solution. Like you can't just buy an Oracle machine or a cluster of Oracle servers and then you're done. You actually have to look at what your use case is, what the access patterns are, what your scaling needs are, and then use a number of different technologies. I don't think you should overuse and have your whole system end up with like a quagmire of fragmented technologies. That's definitely not a good idea, but trying to apply one thing for all the data patterns is not a good idea.
Yeah, again, Doug, thank you very much for joining us today. Also thanks to David Floor, Dave Vellante, to Brian and to Jeff from the airport. I appreciate you dialing in and for your questions and comments today. Just a reminder, we'll have 6 research notes up later this week discussing various aspects of what we learned from today's call. We are publishing on a wiki, so feel free, and Doug, this goes to you as well, feel free to hit the edit button and correct, enhance, or improve the documents. I'll send out to you a list of the documents as they're published. We'll also have a podcast of this research meeting up on the Wikibon site and on YouTube. This later this this week. Thanks again for joining us, and watch the upcoming Peer Insights page for future Peer Insights. Thanks very much.